You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme...
Blatter, I think, I hope, for the sake of football, for the sake of the world game, is now tottering. He's presided over years and years and years of kickbacks, corruption. So, let's just hope he falls in the sea off Sao Paulo.
From FIFA corruption and Ukrainian energy deals to violence in Iraq, we'll discuss the day's top stories with Mary Dajewski and John Everard here in the studio. Then, since it is the eve of the World Cup, more football, this time from a design perspective. Patrick Burgoyne of Creative Review explains the high prices of World Cup kits.
People saying, well, why am I being expected to pay £90 for a simple white T-shirt? And so, you know, there is this interesting argument about aesthetically, it may look better, it's simple, but when they're trying to charge this premium price for it, does it need more detail? Does it need more bells and whistles in order to justify the price?
And later in the show...
Here is the head of that ignoble traitor, the dangerous and unsuspected Hastings.
We'll review the very best in new theatre releases with Matt Wolfe of the International New York Times. All that plus a check-in with our woman in Amsterdam and some music. Oh yes, all here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So much to pack in over the next 60 minutes. First of all, here is Paul Osborne with the latest news bulletin.
Islamist insurgents have seized control of a second city in Iraq. They've captured Tikrit the day after grabbing control of Mosul. Up to 500,000 people fled as the militants cemented their hold of Mosul. Now the head of Turkey's mission in the city and almost 50 consulate officials are being held. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says they must be freed.
And this is a totally unacceptable. As the Secretary General of the United Nations, I'm condemning in the strongest possible terms such terrorist attack against diplomatic officers.
Meanwhile, at least 21 people have been killed in a suicide bomb attack in Baghdad. One of Egypt's most well-known pro-democracy activists has been jailed for 15 years. Ala Abdel Fattah was sentenced for staging an illegal protest and attacking a police officer. He played a key role in the uprising that forced Hosni Mubarak from power in 2011. He's been sentenced 3 days after the former head of the army, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, was sworn in as president. European officials are to investigate the tax affairs of three major companies, Apple, Starbucks and Fiat. All three have specific arrangements in three EU countries, leading to allegations they pay significantly less tax than they should. The US claims Apple pays just 2% tax on its profits. The European Commission is to look at whether the arrangements breach rules on state aid. Pakistan's government is facing calls to do more to tackle the threat posed by militant groups after the weekend's attacks on the airport in Karachi. More than 30 people died in Sunday's attack, and within 48 hours, gunmen attacked security forces there for a second time. Imtiaz Gul, a security analyst and expert on the Pakistani Taliban, says the government appears to have no idea what to do.
Lack of vision, lack of action by successive governments, starting from the dramatic events of 9/11 have led Pakistan into this situation in which the government and the bureaucracy as well as the army seem clueless.
Protests have been staged in cities across Europe against the cab-hailing mobile phone service Uber. The drivers claim it's not properly regulated and in some cases breaches the rules under which other taxis operate. In London, black cab drivers brought one of the city's most famous landmarks to a standstill, blockading Trafalgar Square. Uber has said that it is legal competition for other cabs. But one London cabbie says it's not as simple as that.
We've got a criminal record. We can't be a taxi driver. With Uber, do you know who's going to be driving that car? I don't think so. MOTs, you know, we've got to have quite a lot of tests on these cabs because we're, tr- people are using them every day of the week. Is that happening with the cars that everybody's going to be using? I don't think so.
Spain's parliament has approved the abdication of King Juan Carlos in favour of his son, Prince Felipe. Permission was needed as there is no specific legal basis to cover abdications in Spain. It was approved by a large majority despite some calls for a referendum on the monarchy. Brazil's president says her country is ready for the World Cup, which begins on Thursday. In a televised address, Dilma Rousseff dismissed criticism of the amount being spent on staging the tournament and said that what she called pessimists had been defeated. There have been protests in many Brazilian cities ahead of the tournament, but the president has said she won't allow them to disrupt matches. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul Osborne. It has just turned 18:06 here in London. It's 13:06 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. This is Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ut London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holland.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And I'm pleased to say I'm joined now by the journalist Mary Dajewski and John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. John, Mary, welcome both to the programme. We're going to begin in Iraq, where a sustained attack in Mosul from militants belonging to an al-Qaeda offshoot, the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or ISIS, has succeeded in taking control of Iraq's second largest city. The government has now called a state of emergency, and indeed just hours ago, ISIS fighters have also taken control of Tikrit, the former hometown of Saddam Hussein. John Everard, for many in the West, Iraq has been the story that many of us have almost forgotten and has been sort of pushed to the background because of events elsewhere, most notably in Syria. It's time everyone is taking notice again now, isn't it?
It very much looks that way, doesn't it? This situation seems to get more and more confused as the hours roll by, let alone the days. It's quite clear that Iraq faces a major insurgency, and I very much doubt that the ISIS's aims stop at Mosul and Tikrit. I'm sure they have other cities in their sights as well. One immediate consequence of this is that very soon the Iraqi government in Baghdad is going to have to do some very hard negotiating with the Kurds, because the Kurds, the Peshmerga, the Kurdish armed forces, are at the moment the only armed force anywhere near ISIS forces that have any kind of cohesion and any kind of military capability, which means that they are almost certain to go to the Kurds and ask for help. And the price that the Kurds will ask for in return for this is certainly going to be very steep, may well be formal independence of Kurdistan.
Mary Dajewski, that would be an enormous change for the Kurds in the north of Iraq. Would the Peshmerga actually feel that they want to get involved in this? Or would they actually feel, you know what, this is quite close to where we are as it is. We will concentrate on keeping our own areas safe.
Well, I think that's one of the most important questions, because I agree with John absolutely that what has happened with the power change in Mosul and now Tikrit is that the Kurds and the Kurdish element in this whole conflict has taken on a different proportion. And yes, they might possibly decide that they could, at a price, become a sort of salvation force for Baghdad. But I would rather think that they might, maybe opportunistically, they might take the opportunity to declare full independence, something which they have declined to do. They've been pushed by Western powers. They've been given a sort of quasi-recognition. But this really puts things on the line. And if the Kurds were to declare independence, then you're looking at a possible Kurdistan or pressure for a united Kurdistan right across the northern arc of the Arab region. And that is hugely, hugely disruptive.
And not just the Arab region, of course. There's the whole Turkish-Kurdish question to consider too.
Indeed. And John, that's one of the fascinating aspects of this, what's going on here, is that it's in no way just linked to Iraq. This is linked to what's going on in Syria. And of course, as Mary's saying there, if Iraqi Kurdistan was suddenly to declare independence, that affects Turkey, that affects Syria, that affects Iran as well.
That's right. I mean, I don't think I want to get too excited just yet, but it is not impossible that we are looking at a complete redrawing of the political geography of the entire region. If this goes up in smoke, which it might well do, then Iraq as a state may find, you know, may cease to exist. We may see splits, and we may see parts of what is now Iraq joining on to territories that are currently controlled by other neighbouring states.
Mary, what can the Iraqi government in Baghdad actually do right now? What sort of capability, both militarily, diplomatically, economically, do they have?
I think really they realistically they have very little, and one of the measures is that of that is not just that they've lost control of Mosul and now they've lost control of Tikrit. It is that they seem to have been putting out, informally at least, feelers towards foreign countries, including the Americans and the British, saying, you know, we could do with some help here. And it seems to me that those pleas, if they're being made, are falling on very, very deaf ears indeed.
Absolutely. I think anybody who's dealt with policymakers in either Washington or London over this any time over the last year knows there's absolutely no way that there's going to be a further military commitment to Iraq. If I could just underline here the extent of the Iraqi government's military collapse. When the ISIS fighters entered Mosul, they were outnumbered by the Iraqi army 15 to 1. And they still won. I mean, entire units of the Iraqi army simply ripped their uniforms off, dropped their guns, and ran.
And this is the Iraqi army that supposedly the West, led by the US, has spent the last 10 years training.
That's the one.
Mary, if the Iraqi government can't turn to the US and they can't turn to Britain, who else do they turn to? And what impact might support from elsewhere have on the region?
I think it's very difficult to see who else they could turn to. I mean, one possibly obvious source of support could possibly be Assad in Syria. Both of them are, or nominally, originated in what's called Ba'athist regimes. There are some common denominators there. But it doesn't seem to me that Assad is in a position to help anybody, even if he wanted to, or that if Iraq, as I say, can't hold those cities, then can it actually hold Baghdad for that much longer?
Plus the idea, obviously, of Assad coming to help our allies in Baghdad would make many people's heads spin in the West in terms of, well, whose side is, who are the good guys in all this? But John, sorry, continue.
Yes, I just wanted to say, I think a historical perspective here, let's not forget that as we approach the centenary of the outbreak of the First World War, at the end of that war, there was a Western commitment to an independent Kurdistan. Are we looking at the final compliance, putting into practice of that commitment in the most bizarre way?
An independent Kurdistan is... I mean, one of the interesting things about Iraqi Kurdistan, Mary, is that it has had autonomy for the last 20 yep. years. And anyone who's been there recently will know that it's completely different from the rest of Iraq and essentially runs pretty well with the autonomy it has. And, you know, when I was there last year, I didn't sense any great appetite to push for independence because they kind of felt, actually, as we are right now, we can do pretty much what we want. We can ignore Baghdad whenever we want. Why do you think there might be some in Iraqi Kurdistan now who'd feel, actually, you know what, let's go the whole hog and have independence?
Because being responsible for yourself completely is hugely attractive, especially at a time of enormous insecurity and growing insecurity elsewhere. So long as the rest of Iraq looks stable, then Iraqi Kurdistan could afford to sit on the sidelines and enjoy what stability and prosperity it had. It's not at all clear that it'll be able to do that much longer. So I think that's one reason why they might actually go for full independence.
I think another reason is that to actually have a seat at some of the discussions that are going on in the region and, of course, at the United Nations, you have to be an independent sovereign state. Simply autonomy doesn't cut the mustard.
John, let's mention another element of the complexity in this, which is, of course, the role of Turkey. We heard today from Ahmet Davutoğlu, the Turkish foreign minister, that a number of Turkish diplomats are being held in Mosul. And yes, of course, Turkey is going to be in a curious alliance if they have to then work alongside the Peshmerga in Iraqi Kurdistan when Turkey has its own Kurdish issue and really doesn't want to see any independence for Kurdistan at all.
Well, they're absolutely right. I think this is going to cause an enormous headache in Ankara. There are two quite conflicting policy objectives which are going to be extremely difficult to reconcile. I just don't know which way Turkey's going to go.
Mary, before we move on to another topic, how, and obviously this is a very big question which goes back decades, but how have we got to this stage in the sense that while obviously Iraq has been out of the main headline news for some time, has the diplomatic focus in London, in Washington and elsewhere and other major capitals switched too much that it's allowed things to get out of control without people really sort of having their finger on the pulse?
Well, I think there may be some truth in that. But it also has to be said that when the Western troops were withdrawn from Iraq, then there was a feeling that Iraq was relatively stable and would actually maybe do better by itself than with foreign intervention. Since then, of course, what we've had Egypt, we've had the Arab Spring, we've had Syria, we've had Ukraine. All these things have distracted diplomatic attention away from Iraq. And so now it's been brought back with a vengeance. It also has to be said, of course, that it's probably up to historians to decide how disruptive the Western intervention and the toppling of Saddam Hussein was. It's always, you know, the counterfactuals are very attractive. But in a way, we went in there and we upset the order that there was. And to an extent, there is now a sort of rather poetic reversal of that, in that something akin to the previous order, though without the strong man at the top, seems to be coming back.
Yes, and some people would have heard a former British Foreign Secretary this morning, David Miliband, rather blithely saying, oh yes, well of course, if we'd known now what we knew then, of course I wouldn't have voted for the war. John, just briefly one thing on the diplomatic side of these things. As a one-time ambassador yourself, a number of the people within certainly the British Foreign Office and within the State Department of America who were Iraq experts have for the past 2 or 3 years become Syria experts. They're all working on Syria. They're either in Istanbul or Cairo, or they're working on these issues now. Have we lost, therefore, a lot of Iraqi expertise?
No, I don't think so. I think it actually makes a lot of sense to have the same experts dealing with both Syria and Iraq. I think the two sets of issues are very closely intermeshed. And I doubt very much in any case if the people who have been working on Syria have actually stopped reading up on Iraq. I'm sure they kept themselves current.
Okay. I just want to go on, Mary, one final point before we move on.
One thing to add to that is that I think that the one of the problems about the invasion of Iraq initially was that, at least in the British Foreign Office, they weren't listening to the experts. So if there are now experts that are being listened to, even if they've been diverted to Syria, then that is an improvement.
Mary Dzhevsky and John Everard. We'll leave it there for a moment. Still to come, we'll be talking about corruption in football, of all things. Plus, we'll also be discussing Thailand and Gazprom. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, my guests today, Mo Dojevski and John Everard. We'll turn now to Brazil, where I don't know if you are aware of this, but the World Cup is about to begin. In a television address, Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff announced that her country is ready on and off the pitch. We will see about both of those things, if the Sao Paulo Metro strikes are anything to be said for. It will also, of course, be a time of diplomacy. World leaders are arriving this week for both matches and meetings. Mary Dojevski, it's when sport and politics mixes, it's often a curious combination. A lot of politicians will be going there because they quite like the idea of a trip to Brazil and watching some football. But there will be some serious issues discussed off the pitch, won't there?
Yes, there is a BRIC summit of the emerging economies, which will bring together Brazil and Russia and India and China, which will be actually very important, but probably won't get the attention it deserves. Angela Merkel will be there, not just as Germany's leader, but as an absolute diehard football fan in her own right.
I thought you were going to say, and as Europe's leader as well. But,
I wouldn't but yes. dare say that. Not from London, anyway. Putin will be there, which will probably give the lie to the idea being put around in Europe that he's completely isolated. He will be, I think, in much more familiar and favourable to him territory in Brazil. So there is plenty of opportunities there.
And there are, John Everard, also opportunities for people to meet that perhaps wouldn't like to meet. For example, let's say both Russia and England, I mean, obviously England aren't going to qualify from their group, but let's say Russia and England were to meet, then you would have possibly a meeting of British and Russian ministers in an environment where they perhaps weren't expecting it.
Well, that's possible. But let's remember that David Cameron and Putin did meet in the D-Day celebrations just a few days ago. So a further meeting in Brazil wouldn't be such a shock. I think the big question is, does Joe Biden meet Putin? And everybody keeps being very quiet about that. Famously, President Obama refused to sit down to dinner with Putin over the D-Day. So poor President Hollande had to have two dinners for his two principal guests.
Two dinners, Hollande.
Yes, that's right. Is it easy for the Americans that a vice president meets Putin? Is Putin going to accept a discussion with the vice president? We'll see.
And of course, Mary, there is obviously, as we heard at the beginning of the show from Andrew Jennings, and it's been discussed broadly, certainly in this country over the past few days, this ongoing issue of corruption within FIFA itself. But it has only really been an issue in certain countries, hasn't it? It's very easy for people to read the Sunday Times allegations and see what's going on and think that this is something the whole world is talking about. They're not, though, are they?
No, they're not. And what's coming back are actually accusations, reverse accusations, talking about racism and sort of culturism, about the attacks on FIFA. This is not a story that is over yet. If you looked at it from a European perspective, you would assume that it was accepted that the whole of FIFA was completely drowning in corruption, that the choice of Qatar for the World Cup had been completely dictated by money and nothing else. And the thing is that even if it was, which it may well have been, there are plenty of people who don't see anything wrong with that.
No, that's very true, John. And have you noticed that there is a... let's put it this way. When it comes to football diplomacy, sometimes some of the British representatives aren't that good at building coalitions, are they?
No, that's true. They're not. But I agree with Mary. I mean, I think we have to get this in perspective, that there's no suggestion that FIFA is irredeemably corrupt from top to bottom. There's a certain area of FIFA that is alleged to have taken bribes.
Yeah, the top.
The top and certain voting groups within the council. All right. But I think, you know, we have to face the fact that this that FIFA faces mortal danger, that with 4 out of 5 of FIFA's main financial backers saying they want a thorough and detailed investigation, and I'm sure that such an investigation is going to set up some pretty unpleasant stuff, there's a real risk that FIFA is not going to receive the funding it needs to keep going.
Well, I think you're far more hopeful on that than I am. I'm putting my money on some sort of whitewash, but we shall see. Let's turn now to Ukraine. Mary, Gazprom has pushed back the deadline for Ukraine to begin prepayment of its natural gas supplies. Have you noticed a shift in Moscow's attitude towards Kiev since the inauguration, well, the election of Poroshenko and his inauguration last weekend?
Yes, I mean, I think things have come in two stages. I think there was an initial shift by Moscow when it realised that the prospects of civil war in eastern Ukraine were actually very, very real. And that was the first stage in stepping back. And then there was the election, which I think actually passed off better than almost anybody dared hope. I think almost the silence around it is as though people don't want to say anything, lest it turns out that it was actually less free and fair than it appears to have been, except in certain areas where it didn't take place at all in bits of the east. But I think since then, Putin has actually honoured what he said in the first place about the election, that if it was, in his view, a reasonably okay election, then Russia would regard the new president, Poroshenko, in Kiev as legitimate and would deal with him and would deal with his Ukraine on a state-to-state basis. And I think that's what we're looking at in the backtracking a little bit from Gazprom.
And also, we haven't seen, John Everard, the re-emergence of Viktor Yanukovych, have we?
I was just about to make that very point. Wonder where he's gone. Mm. No doubt sort of tucked away in a mansion somewhere in darkest Russia, told to keep his head down. Not a happy man. I think that the Russians are in a very difficult position over this. Civil war in Ukraine, bad enough. Civil war in Ukraine over which you quite clearly have very little control. I think it's becoming clear that although a lot of the arms that the separatists are using have come from Russia, they are certainly not dancing to Moscow's tune. And of course, now they start to fight amongst themselves, so the situation is getting more and more complex. There's no reason to think, either, that this violence will stay the Ukrainian side of the border. The groups that are fighting in Ukraine are in large part the same groups that were demonstrating in Moscow just a year ago. And the Russians must be getting just a little bit nervous by now. Gazprom's deadline? It's not an equal negotiation. Gazprom needs to sell that gas more than Ukraine needs to buy it, certainly at current prices. And I think we can see that this negotiation will roll forward quite a long way now.
Yes, and I think Ukraine feels that it's in a much stronger position now because it feels that it's got the European Union behind it. Even if that's purely academic, even if the European Union is as reluctant as it ever was to put any money there, any real money, I think that Kiev feels there is European clout plus a distinct reluctance by Russia to tip things over to a more dangerous situation in Ukraine. So I think Ukraine thinks it's got everything to play for and it can get a better deal.
Yes, and I think it's right. We have to remember the present situation is costing Russia very large amounts of money. Not least, Putin still has 40,000 troops out of barracks sitting along that border. He's got hardware, he's got tanks, he's got aircraft exposed to the elements. This is a very, very expensive strategy.
Just finally, before we go, John, I want to ask you about this. A Thai army delegation has today travelled to China to discuss security issues and joint training. China, of course, is a long-standing regional ally of Thailand and perhaps it's fair to say is going to have less concerns about dealing with a military government. The fact that the Thais are talking to the Chinese at a stage, obviously, when the West is still trying to work its way out of how it's going to deal with this. Is that a sign that Thailand is just relying on the neighbours that it knows it can rely on?
No, I think this is just classic flesh creeping, that the Thais have done this deliberately and timed it deliberately so as they hope to send shivers up and down Western spines. We kind of saw it coming and I don't think we're going to rise to this one.
Okay, let's leave it there since we're almost at the bottom of the hour. John Everard and Mary Dajewski, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
In the second half hour of Midori House, we'll be tasting orange-coloured food in the Netherlands. Not literally. Well, not literally tasting it. The food is literally that colour. We'll get onto that, don't worry. Matt Wolfe will be giving us his take on the latest plays in London, and we'll also be talking World Cup design. First, though, here's Paul with the headlines.
Islamist insurgents have seized control of a second city in Iraq. The day after taking control of Mosul, they've now captured Tikrit. Up to 500,000 people have fled Mosul, and the head of Turkey's mission there is among almost 50 consulate officials who are being held hostage. One of Egypt's most well-known pro-democracy activists has been sentenced to 15 years in prison. Alaa Abdel Fattah was sentenced for staging an illegal protest. He played a key role in the uprising that forced Hosni Mubarak from power in 2011. European officials are investigating the tax affairs of three major companies, Apple, Starbucks and Fiat. All have arrangements in different EU countries, leading to allegations of their paying significantly less tax on their global profits than they should. And Brazil's president has said the country is ready for the World Cup the day before it begins. In a televised address, she dismissed criticism of the amount that was spent on staging the tournament and said the pessimists had been defeated. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Paul Osborne, thank you very much indeed. 1932 in Amsterdam, 1832 in London. Let's head now to the Netherlands and the largest city there, Amsterdam. Our regular contributor, Cynthia Taylor, is on the line. Cynthia, welcome to Midori House. Before we get on to orange-coloured food, let's talk about why the Netherlands seems to be the sort of place where if you're a US company, you'd like to be based.
Indeed, there's a new study coming out that says that the Dutch is not simply one of the favorites. It is actually the top tax haven for U.S. companies, beating places such as Bermuda or the Cayman Islands, which are notorious for their tax schemes. The research by Citizens for Tax Justice and Public Interest Research Group say that out of the 500 top U.S. companies, 48% have at least one limited company based here in the Netherlands, and that has moved about $127 billion or 93 billion euros through the country via these tax schemes. Now, why is it attractive, you are asking? Well, tax authorities here are very willing to agree to tax schemes in advance before the company settles in. They are very open to that discussion. There's also several tax agreements between the Netherlands and other countries which prevent double taxation. And when it comes to royalties, for instance, these are absolutely not taxed, which leads me to another scheme, the letterbox scheme, which basically sets a company creates a postal address here for registered purposes, but actually is operating from elsewhere. Notorious companies include those from, you know, by the Rolling Stones or the YouTube because of royalties, but also like Facebook, for instance. And another research in recent years said that this scheme generated 12 trillion euros a year. That's a lot of money.
Well, it might generate that sort of money, but is this money that, quite aside from the fact that the Netherlands is essentially taking from other nations, is this money that actually the Dutch are seeing that goes into the Dutch treasury and then pays for your public services?
Well, one could say that. The Ministry of Finance says it's not only about tax money, that these companies are bringing in production, are creating jobs for the country as well. Not, it's not only about tax schemes. But what this research is saying is that actually what the Dutch Ministry of Finance is saying accounts for just a very small percentage of these $127 billion. And if you look, for instance, at the example that we just mentioned there in the bulletins, Starbucks, for instance, it declared here in 2012 under €1 million in taxes, while it has been reporting losses in UK for most of its 15 years, despite its 800 branches there. And it's all because of these tax schemes that basically the Netherlands allows companies to have here and just to attract them to come here and, yes, generate a lot of money to roll through the country.
Now, the Netherlands is known as being a liberal country, where although we'll come on to just how liberal it is in a moment. Are there groups in the Netherlands that are saying, you know what, actually, this isn't fair, this isn't right, there should be a form of tax justice, these rules should end?
Sure, there's always groups saying that. But at the end of the day, if you look at the Dutch taxpayer, you know, the more money it gets into the pockets, the better, isn't it? Because then the less tax they'll have to pay, and the more they'll get anyway. So yes, it is, especially those who are far more pro-European Union, these groups will say, you know what, it's not fair. If we are creating a European Union, a financial union within Europe, we have to be fairer towards others as well. But, you know, we are still in a crisis and people just really look at their own pockets. They don't think about others. It's looking at what's more beneficial for them.
Let's turn on to that issue I alluded to there about whether the Netherlands is really as liberal as we perhaps think they are. You have an interesting character at Christmas time called Zwart Piet, literally means Black Pete, who is a white person who blacks up, which has become incredibly controversial, certainly last Christmas, because there were complaints raised at the United Nations. There has been a slight change, you're about to tell us then.
It is true. Just for the listeners, so that they understand exactly the Black Pete story, I just give a very brief introduction to the story. As you say, Black Pete is kind of, it's the Christmas season here, so Western European countries will be celebrating Christmas, but the Dutch do that with St. Nicholas on the 6th of December. And basically, the story goes, here in the Netherlands, that St. Nicholas lives in Spain, in a castle in Spain, and he has these servants, the Black Petes, who help him out with making toys for the children. And then eventually, 3 weeks before the celebration, they come to the Netherlands and they start distributing toys for children. Now, the Black Petes go down the chimney. And, of course, going down the chimney, you get, you know, your face gets dirty with the soot, basically. And that's why it's claimed that they are black. They're not really black people. They just are, you know, they have their face dirty with soot. But the problem is that it's not only that. They also have curly hair. They have thick red lips. And the clothes they wear are resembling those of the 18th century when the figure was invented, including a gold earring, basically. So people have been calling for change, as you were saying, also saying that, you know, it's a very racist figure, and a lot of communities here from black origins have been saying that they've been called Black Pete in negative manners. And some even went to court last year trying to ban the figure in the Amsterdam parade, but they lost. Now, yesterday, the Dutch Folk Heritage Center presented what could be a new version of the Black Pete. So forget about the curly hair, they said, no more thick red lips and no more golden earrings. But it is still a white person in black makeup, exactly the same.
Well, let's see then what happens come this Christmas. I'm fairly sure that something is going to rumble on. Just finally, and just briefly, Cynthia, because we're running out of time. The Dutch, when the World Cup or the European Championships roll around, you like to wear a lot of orange. All your fans are dressed in orange. It seems that this year your food is going to be orange as well.
Oh, I wish it would be only this year. It's every single time that there's a World Cup, the world turns orange in this country. The supermarket just has really special food with orange color, you know, just featuring on their shelves. But don't be afraid. I mean, if you cannot find a naturally orange-colored food, they will color it for you. So you'll have things such as pasta, yogurt, milk, pastry, you name it, everything is orange to support the orange team, of course, in Brazil.
Excellent. Okay, well, I'm looking forward to seeing how much you can eat this orange until, of course, the Dutch crash out on penalties. The only team worse than England when it comes to penalty shootouts. Cynthia Taylor in Amsterdam, thank you very much indeed. One more bit of World Cup stuff coming up after this.
From Kotuks to ceramics, cooking utensils to kettles, satisfying solutions are to be found in Monocle's roundup of simply designed and endlessly useful things.
When Lee Stewart and Kailash Parmar met in London, they set out to design the Crash Bang Wallop hanging shelves. Inspired by suspended kitchen utensils, the design stems from the idea of framing the objects within the shelf.
Objects of Desire, a slideshow featuring Monocle's top 25 home helpers, now showing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
The numbers have been crunched, the editors have deliberated, and now we can unveil who came top in our 2014 survey of the best cities to call home. You'll discover the risers and fallers and a few new entries in our July-August summer double issue. It also includes a 28-page travel guide to South Tyrol, the Italian Alpine province, where you're as likely to hear the locals speaking German, and where great hotels, bars and restaurants fill every cute town. And there's more.
In the design section, we head to Auckland to see how a recently rejuvenated works depot in the middle of the city has provided a new home for the city's creative class. And then from bridges in Berlin to baths in Budapest, we discover some of the world's most charming gathering points and also pick out 10 of the best urban details from knobs in Valencia to manhole covers in Japan.
In the edit section, we head to a venerable old market in Porto. Not only has the Mercado de Bilbao put food on the city's tables for the past century, its ongoing importance goes to show that bigger and shinier don't always mean better. We also explore three inner-city enclaves offering an agreeable quality of life from Taipei to London and Santiago.
Monocle's July-August double issue is on newsstands around the world now, or get yourself a subscription at monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. I'm not sure if you knew this, but the World Cup begins in Brazil tomorrow. It's not just about the football, of course. One of the world's greatest sporting events has an impact on so many other facets of modern life, including design. I spoke to Patrick Burgoyne, editor of Creative Review, which has dedicated its most recent issue to World Cup design, about the effect the design world has had on football.
There are two spreads in the magazine where we've looked back at the official balls for the World Cup since 1970, which are all done by Adidas, and also the boots that Adidas designed for each World Cup from the 60s to the present day. And I think with both of them, you can really see the point at which football became so much more commercialized. So, you know, up until around the 90s, mid-90s, you have, you know, quite restrained, quite classic design and branding, quite simple design and branding, and then suddenly, woof, it all just kind of takes off and you get this cacophony of glaring, clashing colours. And I think, you know, a lot of that argument, the brands would say it's about technical innovation. What they're trying to do is make the product better, that they've got access now to so many more new materials, so many more advanced manufacturing processes. They can make things lighter, they can make things better, and that's what drives them. But I think you have to bear in mind the other side of that equation is that there's been a kind of accompanying growth in marketing spend and in brands and in football as an industry. And I think it's no accident that the change in terms of the way these key products are designed and branded coincides with the change in football as an industry, with the advent of, in this country, Sky TV, but more generally satellite television particularly, and, you know, football as an industry.
And as you say, it is about the marketing, and it's about differentiating. It's our football for this tournament has to look different. It has to be different. One, so that we can stand out, but two, so that we can then sell lots of the official World Cup ball. Or with the when you look at the football boots, and as you say, you've got this lovely spread looking at how football boots have developed they want the boots to now be individual for each star player, or indeed for each person that wants to buy the boots.
Oh, absolutely.
You can make your own football boot now and obviously pay far more for it. But
yeah.
Design-wise, in terms of its aesthetic, the way it looks, we haven't necessarily made progress here, have we?
Perhaps there's some nostalgia on my part, but when I look at what's come out this year and compare them to, you know, the classic designs of the 70s, to my mind, formerly, the 70s stuff is just so much more palatable. And I think from a branding point of view, so much stronger as well. When in the case of Adidas, when they stuck to that simple, clean three stripes that was highly visible, the boots that they've come out with for this World
ridiculous.
Cup are...
Yeah, they've got I don't even know what that is.
They've come out with this, you know, incredible kind of black and white geometric design. Yes, the three stripes are still on there, but they're relegated to the heel. It's very, very kind of...
And they're not white. It's a sort of a lurid orange with red sort of lining to it. I mean, it kind of looks like someone's thrown up on it. Or in fact, it looks like two designers have made this and no one could quite decide which one they wanted to go for, so they've gone for both.
Well, that's kind of an interesting point because, you know, the production of this stuff now is there's an awful lot of people involved. So there, you know, in the case of Adidas, you've got a big branding agency in Fitch. You've got a very big in-house team, plus you've got the advertising agency involved as well. So there are many, many, many people involved in this stuff now, whereas before, you know, it would have been relatively few people and much more consistency. So, but it reflects really what's happening in the wider culture. And I think certainly in terms of, you know, consumer products, we've seen so much more stuff which has been, if you like, over-designed and just really being driven by marketing. And as you say, you know, there is this relentless need to come up with something new, something different for each tournament that will sell product. And, you know, with in terms of the balls that Adidas did, they had a design for 20 years, which was pretty much unchanged, which was the Tango, which was introduced in 1978. And yes, there were variations for each tournament, but it was pretty much the same. But there's no way, I don't think, that they would do that now because, you know, they, as you say, they have to come up with something entirely different. They have to tell this story about technical innovation, the fact that it's going to be the fastest through the air, the roundest ball they've ever made, the ball that's going to have the best control for the players. And I don't know how much, you know, how much players really notice except when things go wrong and they complain that the balls misbehave.
You also, in the issue, look at two of the big kit manufacturers, Puma and Nike, who sort of dominate really when it comes to World Cup kits, but they both have...
Well, along with Adidas as well.
Yes, but certainly with a lot of the kits, they're both up there. They both sort of approach them in different ways, don't they? I mean, in their very distinctive styles, you can see what a Puma kit is and Nike one to a certain extent, and Adidas one as well from quite a way away.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing with Nike this year, having said what I said about things becoming more complex, is that they, in their kit designs, have gone very, very simple. And particularly with the England shirt, where there was all that controversy about the price of it and people saying, well, why am I being expected to pay £90 for a simple white T-shirt? And so, you know, there is this interesting argument about aesthetically it may look better, simple, but when they're trying to charge this premium price for it, does it need more detail? Does it need more bells and whistles in order to justify the price? Whereas I think Puma have got something quite interesting going on in that they've been very supportive of African nations and they have a lot of the African nations signed up to supply their kit for them, which has resulted this year in some really interesting designs for Ghana and Cameroon, where they tried to introduce some of the kind of local vernacular patterns and design history into the kit designs. And then there's another kind of interesting story about the very, very tight regulations that FIFA impose on kit designs and, you know, how big your logo can be, how big your national flag can be, what the type has to be, the size of it, the spacing of it. There's a book of 92 pages of regulations for official equipment that run for everything from socks to the goalkeeper's caps to their gloves to the tracksuits that the subs are allowed to wear. It's extraordinary, the detail it goes into.
And there's also been an interesting issue with those kits this year in that there's been more of an emphasis on making sure that you have one light kit and one dark kit. So a number of countries have got rid of their traditional dark shorts. So the black shorts that Argentina normally wear, they're not wearing them. The same with Germany as well.
Yeah, I mean, that comes back to these equipment regulations where, you know, that FIFA tried to be specific in terms of having contrasting colours and ease of identification between teams. I mean, there is a logic to it. I mean, if you try to imagine, well, if it was a complete free-for-all, then people would really, you know, you could end up with some real hideous messes. So there is some logic to restricting what manufacturers are allowed to do with their logos, or what national associations are allowed to do with their brands, and what sponsors are allowed to do. And that has to be done. But when you actually read through what that means in practice, it's quite extraordinarily, really. And of course, all the manufacturers then try and push the limits of that. So, you know, you're allowed to have, I think it is, 2 millimeters wide air holes in the numbers on the backs of the shirts. This is specified by FIFA.
Is there someone who goes around measuring those before each match?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, woe betide the team that's 2.1 millimeters. But Puma, interestingly, took that as an opportunity and made those holes into little star shapes that tied in with their wider visual language for all the marketing that they've been doing over the years. So they do try and push it. Sometimes that goes wrong. So in, I think it was 2004, Puma unveiled this all-in-one kit for Cameroon. So the shorts and the shirt were all one piece. And FIFA didn't like that very much, and actually tried to fine Cameroon and impose a points penalty on them for World Cup qualifying. And now the rules are very specific that the shirts and the shorts have to be separate pieces of clothing. So it does get kind of crazy at some point.
That was Patrick Burgoyne from Creative Review. Their World Cup issue is out right now. You're listening to Midori House. Up next, theatre with Matt Wolfe.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam,
all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
Coming up to the end of the show, still lots of time though left for us to discuss the latest offerings from the London theatre scene. Matt Wolfe from the International New York Times is with us. Matt, hello.
Hello.
We've got, before we get on to the famous people, let's talk about, because, you know, they're all gone to sleep.
They can wait.
Let's talk about Hotel at the National Theatre by Polly Stenham, who is unfeasibly young.
Yeah.
And also, despite that, very experienced.
Yeah, I mean, this is her fourth play. She's 27, so that's pretty good. It's her first play not at the Royal Court. It's her first play not directed by Jeremy Herron. And it's also her first play not set in England. So it's a lot of firsts. I wish I could say that these various breaks from departure represented a move forward. But strangely, this seems like a bit of an aberration for all sorts of reasons. The main problem is it doesn't quite know what kind of play it wants to be. It begins as sort of a father-son touchdown kind of play. Son has a secret he's holding against dad and all hell breaks loose. Then it very quickly turns into sort of Captain Phillips, the Tom Hanks movie on stage,
right,
where a family sort of way off somewhere in an African resort end up being kind of terrorized by pirates. And it's very strange. In fact, one of the Somali characters in it is called Abdi, which is the name of the actor from Captain Phillips who was nominated for an Oscar. So I don't think that's an accident.
Right. Okay. But is this just, you know, look, if you've written four plays by the age of 27, which have all been staged at some of the best theatres in the world, then if only one of them isn't that great, then, you know, that's still a pretty good record.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the best of her four plays was the second, but, you know, that doesn't really matter. I guess it's always good when an artist tries to stretch him or herself. I just wish that this one didn't feel quite so much like an unreconstructed Guardian editorial. Not that I have anything against Guardian editorials, but it's a little bit like, it feels like a first play in that it's as if everything she ever wanted to say about colonialism, the state of the world, kind of the abject also-rans of society, is in this play unfiltered. And it just doesn't ring true, I'm afraid.
Trying to cram far too many thoughts into too short a period of time.
Lots of very convincing stage violence, by the way. So any listeners who are squeamish about violence on stage should be forewarned.
Okay. Let's turn to Kevin Spacey as Clarence Darrow at the Old Vic. He's back.
Yeah, I mean, the violence in this is rhetorical, and I mean that in a good way, because, of course, Kevin Spacey here is playing one of the great lawyer activists that America's ever known, an Ohio-born but Chicago-based lawyer from a century or more ago who presided over many of the defining trials in legal history. I actually saw this play when I was a wee thing with the late, great Henry Fonda on the London stage, and I have sort of a dim memory of it being very worthy and touching for all that. This production actually is much more feisty, more fiery. Kevin Spacey, who, of course, is appearing in his home theatre, the Old Vic, which he's been running for the last decade, absolutely in command of that space, of the material, of his audience. And it's really interesting to see somebody just so comfortable in his own skin and in the skin of his adopted home, because, of course, I mean, he's an American Oscar winner who set up shop in London. So it works on all sorts of different levels.
And does the play work, do you think, for a British audience that, you know, most Brits won't really know Clarence Darrow or the story behind it?
I think it does, because, of course, anyone who's ever felt a kind of liberal-leaning impulse in any walk of life will sympathize with Clarence Darrow's activism. And the funny thing about the play is that some of the arguments, like creationism versus evolution, are being waged now in contemporary society. And there are large swathes of Kevin Spacey's home country, I would venture a guess, where this play could not be performed. So in a funny way, the play finds a more sympathetic audience away from Spacey's Native America than it might in his native America.
Let's turn now to Imelda Staunton in Good People at the Noel Coward Theatre. It was previously on at the Hampstead Theatre, which is, I think, actually rather a good theatre, which is sometimes struggling financially.
Well, the Hampstead went through a pretty ropey patch under a previous regime, but since Edward Hall, son of Sir Peter Hall, took over, the last couple of years it's been going from one success to another and is sold out just the way the Donmar is in the Almeida. I'm flagging this. It's coming to the end of its run, but I think anyone who has been on the fence about seeing it should really see it. Imelda Staunton clearly on her way to a damehood. That's just a matter of when, not if. And this is an interesting play because it's set in South Boston, and it seems in some way very particular to that region, and yet it's absolutely universal in what it has to say about status, money, class. It's about a woman from almost literally the wrong side of the tracks who has a former boyfriend who makes good. She has not made good. And that's essentially the dynamic. And a lot of it has to do with the luck that you're dealt in life. Do we create our own luck? Do we not? And she gives a really first-rate, penetrating, unsentimental performance that I suspect is going to win awards at year's end.
And as you say, it's if we can go back to the Hampstead Theatre and the changes that's gone through, because, you know, London is obviously blessed with huge numbers of amazing theatres. But certainly in recent years, and certainly since 2010, with the issues of cuts, those theatres that have relied on their local councils for money, I know Hampstead relied to a certain extent on Camden Council, and suddenly a lot of the money went. They've had to think again, really, haven't they, about how they survive whilst also actually making sure they don't just go for things they think will be commercial hits.
Yeah, I mean, there used to be a feeling at the Hampstead that they were really catering to their dedicated North London Jewish coterie. And while that coterie is still there, I think their horizons have broadened considerably. I mean, after Good People, they had a production of a show about the Kinks, the pop group, called Sunny Afternoon. That got fantastic reviews. That's angling for West End transfer in the autumn. They're clearly thinking beyond their 320 or whatever it is seat home to something broader, which is what any theater has to do in this mixed economy to stay alive. They're also looking at a lot of American work, which is interesting, unexpected, an American work that isn't parochial, but actually says something to the larger community.
Indeed. A theatre, certainly, to watch once again.
Absolutely.
Matt Wolfe from the International New York Times. Thank you, as ever, for giving us your rundown of the things to see. And Good People is almost coming to the end of its run, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Hurry or you will miss it forever.
Okay, there we are. Matt Wolfe, thank you very much indeed. If you were trying to hurry to... I was going to try and make a terrible segue into the fact it's the end of the show. Anyway, it's the end of the show. Thank you very much for listening. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Mary Dajewski and John Everard. Midori House was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Harriet Baker. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Danny will be back with The Entrepreneurs. That is right after a full news bulletin with Paul Osborne. The Michael Daily is on a little bit later, 2200 hours London time. Midori House back at the same time again tomorrow. But for now, from me, Steve Bloomfield, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
London. 到北京。
This is Monocle 24. Nach Amsterdam,
a Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.